I really enjoy leading singing for Vacation Bible School, but I'm glad I don't have to get up here and do the movements this morning. That was a long week, but a really good week. We had a lot of kids here. We had some really good numbers, and I know some of the kids that came from the community are back this morning. We're glad you're here, and we want you to keep coming, and just remind everyone that's a member here that there's a lot of kids in this community who came to our Vacation Bible School by choice. That's what they wanted to do. And they didn't just show up for the fun day, because we had a good crowd every day. And so that's a great motivation for me to know that there are kids in this community who we don't have to go and pry them and try to convince them that they need to be here. They want to be here. We just need to go out there and find them and get them here. And I think it was a great week. I think a lot of great stuff went on. I want to make sure and mention those who helped prepare and getting things ready at the building and teaching the classes and leading the skits and everything that went on. It was awesome production. I think we did a great job, and I'm really just happy to be a part of all that and glad to have been able to be a part and see what everybody here has done. Ed told me this morning that we have CD recordings of all of the adult classes with Josh and all of the skits. So if you would like a CD with either the adult classes or with the skits or both, just let Deanne know, and when Ed gets those to us, we'll get you a copy of those so you can have some of the information or hear the skits and everything if you weren't able to join us for that time this week. This morning, we're going to look at a different story. We went to the New Testament for Vacation Bible School, and I thought I'd make Ed happy this morning and go to the Old Testament. We'll talk from the book of Ruth a little bit. This story is really just an intriguing story when you think about it, when you look at it. And I want to preface the story with an idea I want to put in your head with an illustration. Have you guys ever seen a video, or maybe some of you who are parents have had this happen with your children? Maybe some of you kids are like me and have had this happen from the other perspective. But you have that situation. I've seen videos on YouTube and Facebook a lot recently where a kid is opening a birthday present and they're expecting something because they've asked for it. They've made it known to mom and dad what they want. They've dropped the hints. They've left the magazines open to that page. They've left the web browser on that thing so when mom and dad would get on the computer, there it would be. They've done all their homework in the background, what they needed to do to make sure that when birthday time came, mom and dad knew exactly what they were wanting. And I saw one the other day where a little boy, his birthday party, he sees this box and it's a perfect size, he thinks, and he gets up and he starts ripping into that box and he's just throwing paper everywhere, and he pulls all that paper back and he stops and he looks at the box, and on the front of that box it says, "Home Pottery Kit, make pottery at home, fun for the whole family." I'm sure you can imagine that a 12-year-old kid was not looking forward to a pottery kit for his birthday, and so there's this look of confusion in his eyes. He's thinking, how did this happen? I was very clear. I did everything I could to prepare my parents to let them know what I wanted. Why did this happen to me? He has this look of confusion on his face as he looks at that box, but that confusion turns to hurt. You almost see pain in his eyes as he thinks, why me? Why am I the kid who asks for an Xbox and gets a pottery wheel? Why am I the kid who has to be the one who has parents who think it'd be better to get a pottery wheel than an Xbox? Why would they do that to me? Why would they dare wrap that box up? And that hurt and confusion turns to anger. And there's a fire in his eyes. He bites his lip. He pushes that box across the table and he runs off out of the room back towards the bedroom, I suppose. Slams the door along the way. And all the adults and the kids are just kind of sitting there looking around the table stunned as the little boys run off and they're left there just holding the pottery wheel box. You know, as adults, we kind of learn to deal a little better with disappointment, but I think most of us can understand where that kid's coming from. I think even as adults, we know what it's like to have that expectation of one thing and get another. Some of you wives, you might have taken your husband to the mall and you might have pointed out exactly what it was you were looking for, and you showed it to him multiple times and you talked about it in conversation and you brought up who has it and you made sure he knew that, and you for some reason kept telling him your shoe size over and over all week, which didn't make sense to him at the time and obviously didn't make sense to him at the end either, because you open up your present and it looks like a shoe box, but inside there's a Nutrisystem starter kit, and that's a bad gift to get, isn't it, fellas? Yes, absolutely. She's not happy with that. Maybe you husbands have been wanting the latest Apple gadget and you've made those hints known. You drop those hints to your wife and you open up the box and it's the right size, but inside there's a new pair of nose hair clippers or Rogaine or something of that nature. And you realize you don't always get what you want. Sometimes you get what you need instead. We know those moments. We know what it's like. We know what it feels like to experience that bitterness and that aggravation. And although we don't run off and physically slam the door, maybe in our heads we do a little bit like that young man did. We get upset, we get angry, we get bitter. We want to throw the package against the wall and run back to our bedrooms, but we're adults, so we can't do that, so we just do it mentally. But I wonder if you've ever experienced moments like that in life, in areas that are a little more important than a gift or a birthday present. Maybe it's even been recently. Maybe you've been unwrapping this box in your life that you expected to be one thing, and it turned out to be another. Maybe it was at school, maybe it was at work, maybe it was with your family. You expected things to work out one way, you expected things to go a certain direction, and after you opened it up and you looked at that box, it wasn't what you thought it was going to be. It wasn't what you expected it to be, and so you get a little aggravated. Many of us have been in that situation, and I bet you that most of us, if not all of us, could tell stories from our life, give illustrations or examples of situations or scenarios where we've unwrapped a box, and that box was not what we were expecting. We've looked for one thing, we've received something completely different. So this is the situation that we're going to read about today in the book of Ruth a little bit. This is a situation we're going to look at with this family and that's involved in this perilous situation. And I want you this morning to use your imagination. I want you to go back to being a child and use your imagination and imagine there's a video camera that's rolling continuously. There's a documentary being made about this family, and I want you to see the expressions on their faces. I want you to see the feelings that they experience. They go through this roller coaster of life. There's going to be expressions of joy, of disappointment, of confusion, of sadness, of anger. And in their story, as you begin to read it and think about it, you begin to realize that it might apply to our own lives in a lot of ways. You begin to realize that this is kind of like the things that we go through. One of the things you might consider, you might ask as you read through the book of Ruth is, why is it even in here? Why is the book of Ruth in here? It doesn't seem like a book of the Bible. It doesn't read like a book of the Bible. It's in the period of the judges, and it just doesn't seem to fit because it doesn't talk about the judges or the Israelites. It just seems kind of like an odd place for it. And so you read the book and you think, this doesn't fit. Why is Ruth even in the Bible? And that's a question I want you to consider and keep in your mind as we go on today. It's a story about a husband and a wife, Elimelech and Naomi. In the beginning of the story, we don't have a picture of Naomi, but we know that her name means pleasant or sweet. And as you look at the beginning of the story, you can see that in Naomi. She has a husband, and I'm sure there was joy and excitement as they were married. And later on, two sons came into their lives, and the happiness and the joy of building that family has continued. And so she has a husband, and she has two sons, but as we pick up in the story, that expression begins to change. It's no longer happiness and joy, it's confusion, because there's been a famine now in the land for quite some time, and this famine is so severe that they can no longer stay where they are. I think that's hard for us to understand. I think it's hard for us to understand the concept that we might have to leave where we live because of a famine, because we haven't experienced that in our lifetime for the most part. We haven't had a time when we couldn't go down and get stuff in the store, most of us anyways, and make do at times like that. So it's hard for us to imagine what this family's going through. This famine that's so great that it's taken away everything they need to survive. And I think that's something that's hard for us to understand, but it would kind of be like your husband coming home and just being in a bad mood and being upset, and he doesn't really want to talk about it, but as you lay down that night, he says, they let me go at work today. And you tell him, it'll be okay, you know, that's too bad, I hate that, that's going to be rough, but we can make do, we've got savings, and you'll find another job, you're a good guy, you're likable, you're responsible, you're dependable, you'll do all the good things you need to get the next job, it'll be all right. But 6 months passes and he still hadn't found another job, and you have to sell a car, and a year passes and you have to move out of the house into an apartment. And as time passes and continues to go, you realize that the industry your husband worked in is no longer applicable in the area. There are no jobs available, and he's too old for these jobs and too inexperienced for other jobs. And finally, you decide you have to leave. You've got to move your family somewhere else. That's kind of what they're going through here. That's where they've gotten to. They've lost everything they had. They can't even feed their family anymore. Times have gotten really, really tough, and they say, well, we've got to move. We've got to go somewhere else. And they say, well, that's okay. I mean, people do that, right? Sometimes people lose a job or get a job and you move. You have to go somewhere new. You have to start over. That's normal. But it wasn't really normal for the people here in the Promised Land, because Being there was a part of who they were. You see, each family, each group had land that was theirs. It was passed down, it was their inheritance, and they kept that land for the family. And so they had ownership in the promised land. This was who they were. This was part of their family. It was part of their heritage, their ancestry. It was part of what they were all about. And so to leave that behind was not just to sell a house and move. It was to leave everything they had known. It was to leave the comforts of their family and their friends and their entire existence behind and go somewhere new. And they got to the point where they had to do that. That had to be tough for them. And so they say, you know, it's time to go on. And so they move on to Moab. Now, Moab is not far, if you look at a map, from where they were, but it was far in the idea that it was a foreign land where the lifestyle was completely different. The Moabites are the descendants of Sodom. This is not a good, God-fearing country. This is a country where pagan culture is rampant, where worship of false gods is the norm, where things are very different than what they're used to, where things are very different than what they might have experienced back at home. And so they go into a place where there's a lot of prejudice, a lot of dislike for the Israelites, and they go in here, they move into this area that would be considered usually a very hostile area for a child of God to move into. But they're desperate. They really don't know what else to do. And so they move into Moab. And I can imagine as they leave, Naomi thinking to herself, I've lost everything. I've lost my home, my land. I'm losing it all. But at least I've got my husband and my sons. And if we go to Moab, we can feed them. We can keep our family alive. And that's the most important thing. And so I've got that and I'm okay. She even later says in the book that she left for her town, left for Moab, feeling full, feeling excited about something new, something better for her life. But they get to Moab and her husband gets sick. And he doesn't get any better. He becomes weaker and weaker, and eventually her husband dies. And here she is, a single mom with two boys in a foreign country. She no longer has her family and her support system around her. She's on her own in a hostile country. That had to be tough. Their boys grow up and they marry and they get married to Orpah and Ruth. And so now she has daughter-in-laws that are sons, and things seem to be back to normal. Things seem to be getting a little better. But then right after two weddings comes two funerals. Both of her sons pass away. And so she left in a foreign country with nothing but her two daughter-in-laws. And she doesn't really have anything left in that country to work for, to look forward to gain from being there. So she decides she really doesn't have much of a choice but to go back. Go back to home. Go back to the promised land and hope for the best. Hope things are better there. Hope she can make do as she gets back home. And so she gets ready to leave. So she tells her two daughters-in-law, Orpah and Ruth. She says, I got to go back home. I got to go back where I'm from. But you girls, you are young. You stay here. These are your people. You can find other husbands. You can remarry. You can reestablish your life and make things here and home. But I need to go back. And Orpah agrees and says, okay, that sounds like a good idea to me. But Ruth is not having it. Ruth is not going to leave her side. In chapter 1 of the book of Ruth, starting in verse 16, she says, do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts me from you. So here's this daughter-in-law saying to her mother-in-law, you've probably heard, saying this to her mother-in-law. She's looking at her and saying, I'm not going to leave your side. I'm going to be there with you no matter what. I'm going to stay with you through thick and thin until I die. You might have heard this text before, these two verses. You've probably heard them at a wedding because that's usually where they're used. And usually the bride and the groom face each other and these verses are read and they repeat them to one another. But if we want to go back to the biblical text here and use it in the right way, the bride would turn towards her mother-in-law and say, wherever you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. And I don't think that's going to happen. But that's what's going on here because she's that committed to her mother-in-law. She's that committed to taking care of this poor woman who's lost everything. She's committed to doing whatever it takes to help her, even if it means her life's going to be more difficult, even if it means it's going to be more of a struggle than it had to be if she'd have stayed back in Moab, found a new husband, and reestablished her life. She's going to go with her. And Naomi realizes she's not going to convince her otherwise. The next verse says, when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. She saw what was going to happen. She knew she was going, and so they begin to go back home. They go back to Naomi's hometown. Naomi's hometown is across the mountains, and they come to a little town called Bethlehem. And we start to see why this story may be in the Bible. We get some indication why it might be here. Bethlehem is a small town, just a couple hundred, few hundred people. And when Naomi returns, it's big news. They see her coming. They hear she's there. And they begin to talk about her. And they ask, is this her? Is that Naomi? It doesn't look like her. It doesn't look like the same person who left. Because you remember, her name meant pleasant. Her name meant sweet. They say, is this really Naomi? But Naomi says, look, don't call me that anymore. Don't call me that, because God has made my life bitter, not sweet. She says, the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me, and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me? Can you see the expression on her face? Can you see the emotion? Can you feel it in her voice? She's come back home. A woman whose name means pleasant, a woman whose name means sweet, a woman who obviously had a certain reputation of being just that. And she says, don't call me that. I'm not pleasant. I'm not sweet. I'm bitter. I'm upset. I'm hurt. I'm frustrated. I'm angry. I wonder if that feels familiar to any of us. I wonder if we've been there. We get to that point where something we've reached for, something we've hoped for so long, something we thought that we were going to get eventually, something we felt like was coming soon, never appears. It never comes. And we end up in a situation where instead of going up, we only go down. Things get harder. Things get tougher. And so here's the question. What's this story all about? What is this story talking about? What's it really about? Now, up until this point, you can read it and say, well, this story is easy. It's about loss. It's about hurt. It's about struggle. It's about a woman who loses everything. Her home, her land, her family. She loses everything. Let's ask another question. Does it have to be about loss? Does the story have to be about losing everything? She lost a lot. She had incredible pain and loss, but is that really what the story has to be about? I was listening to an interview on the internet the other day I found through Google, and it was a professor named Gerald Seitzer from Whitworth College in Spokane, Washington. He had been in a wreck a few years back, and in this wreck, he had lost three generations of women in his family. His mother, his wife, and his daughter. All three died in that wreck, but he came out of it unscathed, uninjured, and went on with his life. He wrote a book, and in that book, they're talking about it. What he experienced after that moment where he realized he had lost everything, the years that came after that. And that book's called A Grace Disguised. I think it's a good title. In that book, he says, the experience of loss does not need to be the defining moment of our story. The defining moment can be our response to the loss. The story doesn't have to be about the loss. The story could be about our response to that loss. In other words, that we don't get to decide what roles we'll play. We don't get to decide what's going to come in our lives all the time. We don't always get to choose which situation we will be in and what role we will play in the situation, but we do get to choose what we will do with the role that we've been given. And so we reach a point in loss. We reach a point in the story where we have to decide, is this going to define me? Is this hurt? Is this pain? Is this disappointment? Is this struggle going to be what defines the rest of my life? Or is my life story going to be something different? Am I going to decide to play a different role? That's hard. That's got to be especially hard in the moment as people deal with things that I've never had to deal with, struggle with losses that I don't understand. That's got to be difficult. And Naomi's at that point. She's lost everything. She's gone back home. She has nothing left. And she says, don't call me Naomi. Don't call me pleasant, because I'm bitter. I'm upset. But here's what we're going to see. That there's one word to describe the story of Naomi. It's not loss. It's redemption. It's redemption. And the great thing about redemption that we all want, that we all long for, is that in order to be redeemed, we have to be lost at some point in time. And so a point of loss, while difficult and painful, is also a point of hope, because there's always the hope for redemption. I want to read for a moment, and I'm going to try to read through this as quickly as possible, but I think the writer does a lot better job of explaining the situation than I could by putting it in my own words. We're going to read from the book of Ruth. If you have your Bibles and you want to follow along, that would be great. We're going to start chapter 2, and I'm going to give you a quick recap and then read a little bit. In chapter 2, they're back home, and Ruth is asking Naomi if she can go out and try to gather some from the fields, the edges of the fields that's been left behind. And so she asks her, can I go out and glean some grain from the field? And Naomi says, yes, please go. And so she goes out and begins to pick up from the edges of the field, and she ends up in the field of Boaz. Well, Boaz comes out of Bethlehem, comes out to the farm, to the field where they're working, and he asks the men there, who is this woman that's out here picking up around the edges? Who's this woman gleaning from our field? And he said, well, that's Ruth. That's Naomi's daughter-in-law. That's who that is. And she's been out here working all day. She got here early this morning, and she's been working all day long beside us. She stopped once for a break, but that's it. She's been working hard the whole time. And so she continues to work. Boaz goes to her and says, listen, he says, get as much as you want, get as much as you need. When you need a water break, go get some water with my servants. When you need to take a break, go get in the shade with my servants. Follow my maidservants, my women who are working, follow them around, stay close by their side, and let them help you and protect you from anything. And you just be like one of my servants. You're part of this work group now. You just work as hard as you want to and collect as much as you need. And so she goes home, and as Pat read for us this morning, she goes back and tells Naomi what's happened and tells Naomi about how Boaz came and just took her in as one of his own and said, hey, collect whatever you want, get everything you need, and made her part of his work crew and said, you know, you're protected, you have the water just like everybody else. And Naomi said, you know, that's one of our kin folks. That's one of our family members. He's part of us. And so they're making these connections here, and they're seeing what's going on. And Naomi says, you know, may God bless Boaz for the great thing he's done, because he's basically given us life by giving us the food we need to live. And so in chapter 3, I want you to follow along with me as I read for a few minutes. Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our relative, with whose young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your cloak, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. And she replied, all that you say I will do. So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law commanded. And when Boaz had eaten and drinking and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet and laid down. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. He said, who are you? And she answered, I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer. And he said, May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, rather rich or poor. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do all that you have asked. For all my fellow townsmen know you are a worthy woman. Skip down to verse 16. It says, and when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, how did you fare, my daughter? Then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. So Ruth goes down and takes a chance here. She puts herself at his mercy and says, you've been great. You've helped us already. What can I do for you? And Boaz says, I'll take care of you. I'll make sure you have what you need. I'll make sure and look out for you. Now, they haven't been back in Bethlehem a long time. But he says, the people have already told me what kind of person you are. She's already developed a reputation. And they see her and say, you're a good person. You're a hard worker. You're a loyal individual. You've proven yourself. And I want to take care of you. So in chapter 4, Boaz takes care of some business. He goes and talks to a man who's a closer relative and offers the opportunity for this man to take the land, and that he would take Ruth's hand. But this man is afraid he'll lose his inheritance if he does so. And so it comes back to Boaz, which I think Boaz wanted, as the story seems to show. And Boaz takes Ruth as his wife. He redeems Ruth and he redeems Naomi. He makes her his wife, and together they have a son. And it's so interesting as you look at the story how Naomi thinks that she's coming back to her hometown empty. She thinks she's coming back and that God has abandoned her. But if she wipes away the tears long enough, she'll see that God is at work in the midst of what seems to be an incredible loss. She sees that God is working in her life, that God is at work redeeming her story. I want to look real quickly, I'm almost done, at some of the ways he redeems in this situation. He redeems her story of loss with an unlikely friendship. An unlikely friendship. You know, God has a way of doing this. We experience loss and grief in our life. We experience difficulty in our life. And he brings along someone who understands what we're going through. Someone who can get us through that moment. Someone who can help us in those times when it seems like there's no way out. It's interesting, the situation that the one who God has given to Naomi to help her through a time of difficulty, she tries to push away. She tries to tell her, stay here, don't go with me. You stay back here in Moab and take care of yourself. And I think we do that a lot of times when we go through a loss. When we're struggling, when we're down, when we're disappointed and upset and bitter and mad, we tend to push away people who are trying to help us. People who are trying to reach out and pull us up. Who are trying to make us feel better. We try to push them away. And I think we see here in this situation with Naomi that sometimes when we're struggling, God blesses us. He redeems us through an unexpected relationship. Someone who can pick us up. Someone who can make things better. And a lot of times in life, that's just what we need. Someone to hold our hand. Someone to hug us and tell us it's going to be okay. They've been there. They've experienced that. They know what we're going through. And they can help us through those situations. He redeems her through an unlikely relationship. Number two, we also see that he redeems loss through this undeserved kindness of Boaz. As they go back home, and this is an interesting situation, it seems kind of odd to us in our culture that she would go back to her kinmen and then she would go lie at his feet and wait for him. That was just a really odd situation for us to understand because it doesn't really fit our style of dating. You know, we don't tell our daughters, go lie at his feet and he'll tell you what he wants to do. We don't do that because that's just not our way of working today. But in that time and place, that was how it happened. That was normal. That was tradition. That was the way it was supposed to go by law. And so she does exactly what she's supposed to. She lays herself at his feet. And Boaz, a man who is pretty well off, who is pretty well respected, who takes good care of his servants, who has a good reputation, looks down at this lady and says, looks down at Ruth and says, I want to take care of you. I want to redeem you. I want to make things better. Something that he didn't necessarily have to do, he chooses to do because he wanted to help her out. He redeemed Naomi and Ruth through an undeserved kindness. Something we can all experience, many of us have, in baptism, as God has redeemed us, even though we did not deserve it. And so you keep reading the story. You keep looking down at the story, and the question comes to mind, why in the world would Boaz care so much about this little girl who's out here on the edge of his field picking up the leftovers? Why in the world would he have time for that? He's a busy man. He's an important man. He's got a large farm to run here. Why is he worried about her? Well, it's pretty interesting as you read through the story. It turns out that we know the mother of Boaz, and her name is Rahab, the prostitute from Jericho who protected the Israelite spies. And so Rahab has a son, Boaz, who now is the lead story in our lead character in our story, and sees a chance to redeem another. It's amazing how the family of God pays it forward time and time again. It's amazing how the saving of this one woman leads to the saving of Naomi and Ruth. He grew up to be a man who honored God, and because of that, he does this undeserved act of kindness for Ruth. Number three, final one. He redeems the story with an unpredictable ending. I think this is one of the most awesome things about the Bible, is that when you sit down and you read it, and you go through it, and you look at all these stories, and you start putting things together, you see how great God is. Because he takes people from walks of life, from situations that we would look at and say, they're not anything important, and makes them some of the greatest heroes that we have in the Bible. And so at the end of chapter 4, the end of the book of Ruth, we're at the very tail end here as it's concluding. It talks about it. It says, so Boaz took Ruth and she became his wife, and he went to her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the woman said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. And it's pretty obvious at that point why this story is in the Bible. Because we know, as you go back and look at the lineage in Matthew chapter 1, you see this exact list one more time. And you see that Ruth was an important part of the life of our Savior Jesus Christ. She was a part of that lineage. That lineage that included Rahab the harlot, Boaz her son, and now his wife Ruth and her son Obed. I think if you've ever seen those videos I was talking about earlier online, you've seen the confusion and the hurt and the anger. But I was watching this one last week I was talking about, and the mom goes in there and brings her son back out, and he comes out and he's got puffy eyes from crying, and he's still sucking that bottom lip and still kind of upset. She brings him back out and says, "Just open the box. Just open the box. Look what's inside the box." And so he gets in there and he's still a little upset, but he begins to open the box, and those tears drop really, really quick. So he looks down in there and there's the Xbox and a couple of games and a couple of extra controllers. And you realize it's in that box because mom couldn't fit all that in the Xbox box. It had to have a bigger one for all the stuff she got him. That's what I'm saying this morning. Sometimes we open boxes in life and they don't look like what we expect. They don't look like what we're wanting them to be. But if we would have patience with God, accept that He knows what's best for us, accept that He's in control, and not just throw the box off and run away, but instead open that box, see what's in there, and figure out how we can use it in our lives, we can experience redemption like Naomi and Ruth experienced through their loss, through their difficulty. I think that's what I love about this story of Ruth. It's one I can relate to. You see, in other stories in the Old Testament, we have where God talks directly to people. He has the burning bush, and He has Noah and the ark. We have Jonah and the whale. We have Daniel in the lion's den. But in the case of Ruth, it's just an average woman with normal people with average situations. And she shows that if you stay true to God, stay faithful to God, He can take care of you. He redeemed her through relationships, through kindness, and through her whole lifestyle, her whole life situation, to an ending that none of us could have expected, but all of us would want in our own life. And so the question for us this morning, we need to ask ourselves, is what is in our box? And what is our story of redemption? This morning, if you're a child of God, you've already experienced redemption. You've had the blood of Jesus Christ wash away your sins. You've experienced it to a level that we cannot comprehend. You experienced the love of God where He sent His Son down the cross to give us that freedom. He's redeemed us from our sin. He's brought us from a state of loss to a state of salvation. But maybe there's someone here this morning who hasn't experienced that just yet in their life. Maybe there's someone here this morning who's yet to become a child of God, and you know that in your current state, you're lost. You know you're struggling through life trying to find your way, and it's not working out. And I can tell you this morning, the reason it's not working out is because God's not in control. But He wants to be. And if you want to have that redemption story to tell of your own this morning, why not make your life right with God? Why not come to Him, repent of your sins, confess His name, and take Him on in baptism this morning? Maybe there's someone here who's already a child of God, but you've fallen away, and you need another redemption story. You need those sins washed away. You need those sins taken away by prayer. Ask God. He'll forgive you. And if you need the help of the church to do that, to overcome whatever it may be, let us be like Boaz. Let us help you when you need it, so that when we need it, we can turn to you for help. We're a family, and a family takes care of each other. Let's take care of one another this morning as we stand and as we sing.